Blog Talk Radio.
Greetings and welcome to Mount Olympus. I am Hercules Invictus, and today on Living Legends, I'm honored to have as a guest the legendary director, writer, pop culture icon, musician, artist, and visionary, Donald F. Glut. Greetings and welcome, Donald. Welcome back to the show. How are you?
I'm fine. I'm glad I'm a living legend. You know, the alternative isn't too attractive.
Yes, I could say so. So what have you been up to lately? Last time we spoke, you were launching a series with Machiste in the pages of a black and white magazine, and he had met Dracula, and I loved the story. Did that continue?
No, it didn't. I wrote two more Machiste stories, emphasizing the fact that he turns up in these different eras, but the publisher, at least for now, didn't want to do them because he didn't want to give the impression in the magazine that it was going to be an ongoing series, like in the Warren magazines, and they were doing the Rook and all those characters, Dax the Warrior. Those all became regular series, and
yeah.
He wanted to keep the anthology of the magazine intact. So they're sitting here, they're ready to go anytime they want to do them. I'd love to do a series, actually. In one of the stories that I wrote, I found a way of curing him of his vampirism. And then another one was set in the Old West, where he actually wore a gun belt. He becomes a sheriff to kill a werewolf that's been plaguing the town and the ranchers and everything. So maybe someday those will come out.
I hope so, because I really enjoyed the Dracula one. It brought back a lot of nostalgic memories of the Machiste movies and the Dracula movies I grew up with and enjoyed. So there you combined the best of both worlds and made something really unique. And you worked on a lot of those. You worked on like Dagar the Invincible and Dax and a lot of He-Man and a lot of those.
Yeah, I never worked on Dax. I worked on Dagar for Gold Key, and I worked for Marvel on Cull, and I also worked for Marvel on Solomon Kane. I don't know if that's considered a sorcery character, but I did all three of those, yes.
Yeah, Solomon Kane, I consider him. All of Robert E. Howard's characters were kind of connected with each other, and Marvel made sure that connection was fresh in people's minds. And I believe they did a story where these were all reincarnations of Conan. So you brought a lot of joy to a lot of people, and you continue to do so. Before we get into your journey, and again, you started off by making movies, and you made like over 40 movies before getting involved in the movie industry. That is so awesome. I can't even tell you. What are you busy with these days? Because you're always busy.
Well, I'm busy. I'm always busy with something. I've been working a lot on my website. I have 5 or 6 websites. I keep updating them and adding things and taking things off and making things better. I've been writing more comic books stories for Shudder and Vampirus Carmilla. There's going to be a new edition of my first movie, my first professional movie, Dinosaur Valley Girls, coming out sometime this year with all kinds of new bonus features and everything. And a lot of my old books are being reissued. There's a company called Strange Particle Press that wants to, they approached me. They wanted to get all my books, my old books that were out of print for many years, back in print. They wanted all of them in print. And I said, okay, but not the dinosaur books, because the dinosaur books, there were all kinds of complications, with paying museum for photo reproduction rights and updating, and it was just too much of a project. So we put the dinosaur books aside, and we're doing Frankenstein Legend came out last year, followed by the Dracula book. The next one will be classic movie monsters, and then after that, I don't know what will be next. There's a book I wrote couple books I did with Jim Harmon, one on old television shows and one on old movie serials. Those are going to be coming out this year. And also, there are two books relating to Dinosaur Valley Girls that will probably come out around the same time as the new Blu-ray reissue of the movie. One is a novelization, if you can believe that, and the other is a making-of book, the day-to-day trials and tribulations I went through making a movie. And that movie, by the way, one of the stars of that movie was Ed Fury, who is still with us. And, you know, Ed Fury played Machiste at least once. And he played, what was the name of the character? With the lions and the
He's played. The titles were interchangeable in a lot of those movies, and they.
Yeah, but I'm thinking of the character. The character Ursus, as he put it.
Ursus, okay.
And he plays a cave leader in Dinosaur Valley Girls, and in sort of an homage to the old Italian films, I named him Urso. So that was kind of an in joke. So this is what I'm doing now. Just trying to keep, you know, just trying to keep busy. You know, things slowed down when the pandemic hit. So I spent a lot of time at home. But, you know, a lot of the work I do is at home. So, you know, I got to really get prolific with the comic book stories and kind of hone my craft, as they say. I think the comic book stories I'm doing now are the best I've ever done. And it's funny, I sort of come full circle because my comic book writing career started with Warren, writing for Creepy, Eerie, and Vampirella, and now I'm writing the same kind of stories with the same kind of magazine, but they're much better.
that would, you've raised the bar, on the type of stories you write, so if these are better than anything you've done before, I really want to read them, so I'm looking forward to reading them.
Yeah.
Now, going back to the beginning, you've always wanted to make films, I guess, because you made 41 films before you
42.
Started.
Oh, no, 41, you're right, 41.
Before you started your professional filmmaking career. And these were collected and put out in a set, if I'm not mistaken.
Well, I didn't start out to make movies. I mean, I love movies. I would love to have made, but I didn't start out to be a writer. I didn't start out to be an artist, a lot of these things. What I really wanted to be in those early days, my teenage years and early 20s, you're going to laugh when I tell you this, but it's absolutely true. My big dream was to be a rock star. And I was very proficient with music. You know, when I was in that band, the Penny Arcade, I almost achieved that until the Monkees got canceled and our producer, Mike Nesmith, couldn't afford, you know, paying the bills of another band anymore. So I had to go to I'm always good at seizing opportunities. And I did a little acting. I did a TV commercial with Dick Clark that I lived off of the residuals for about 2 years. And I did some writing of books, you know, opportunities that came my way. And one of them was writing comics. And just one thing kind of led to another. I didn't make my first I sort of figured because, you know, I didn't have any relatives in the business. I wasn't sleeping with anybody in the business. I was this kid from Chicago, and, you know, how was I going to get in the business? And I spent a lot of time in the music business while my contemporaries were making their movie connections. So I was, you know, well into middle age when the opportunity came up to make my first movie. And everything just sort of took off from there. A lot of people they say opportunities are never lost. They're just passed on to someone else. And I never let an opportunity slip by.
I'm not as good at it as you are, but I'm this much the same way. I'm always receptive to any opportunities, and I'm willing to explore possibilities. So that is a great thing to discover it as early as you discovered it, and you've certainly run with it. And you remain a musician, am I not correct? Or
pardon me?
You still remain a musician as well, so you didn't.
Oh yeah, I love playing music. You know, I don't do a whole lot of it anymore. I certainly don't want to play in a band that's playing at nightclubs or bar mitzvahs or birthday parties and things, you know. But I think I'm the happiest one. I'm up there with a couple other musicians and we're just jamming. And I'm up there with a microphone and singing some old songs. You know, that's the best time for me. And it happens too rarely, unfortunately.
It happens rarely? I'm sorry.
No, it happens too rarely.
Is your music out and available for people to listen to?
Yeah. The Piano Arcade music is out from Sundays Music in New York. It's out on CD, and then there's an album out on vinyl, believe it or not, and a new vinyl album with the like the lost songs, you know, that's going to be coming out this year. So you can get it. And my name back then was we all had nicknames and things. So mostly people knew me under the nickname of Marvel. So
Marvel?
The old fan magazines, you won't see Don Gluten there. You'll see Marvel in there, but that's me.
Oh, very cool. So you were a comic book character in your own right.
I'm saying that again. Connection isn't the greatest here, but what?
You were like a comic book character in your own right with a superhero name as you played music. I'm sure if that continued, that would have developed into some sort of a saga.
Well, I didn't come up with that name because my nickname ever since grammar school, and it's sort of come back now, is Dinosaur Don. So when we were in the when I was in the Penny Arcade, one of the lead singers said, "We got to, you know, Don is such a boring name. You know, we have all that to have nicknames." And because I was in the Marvel comics, and also Captain Marvel, the original Captain Marvel, that's the name they gave me, and that's what stuck. And there are people to this day, from my old music connections, my old music friends, that that's what they call me when they call me. Hey, Marvel, how you doing? You know.
All right.
Which I don't mind.
No, I wouldn't either. It's great that the people are still calling you that.
Yeah. I love it when people call me that because those are one of the happiest times of my life when I was in that band, those 2 or 3 years. And it brings back so many good memories and things of what it was like back then and what I did back then and who I knew back then, you know. And it was great.
You ever think of making a movie of your life back then?
No. My past life is very private. Most people don't know anything about it, and they never will. That's why, you know, people say, "Why don't you write an autobiography? You've known so many people, and you had so many adventures and things." And it couldn't be accurate unless I mentioned the things I can't talk about, you know. Because all those things contributed to what I became and what I am now. So I'm just leaving that to, I won't say the history because it's not recorded anymore anywhere and it won't be. So I stick to the factual things, you know, like what I did and, you know, what this led to that and, you know, seeing this movie inspired that book, you know, that kind of stuff.
Okay, because you could fictionalize it. You have an extensive history of writing fiction, so you could make it very exciting, too, because of the type of fiction that you've written or you film. So you don't have to say it's you. You could, but the stories can be conveyed as fiction, because I'm sure they're amazing.
Well, I'll say this. There was a little bit of me in two things, and one, a little bit of me in the Dr. Spector comics I did for Gold Key. And there's a little bit of me in the Burt Winslow character who is a running character in my New Adventures of Frankenstein series of novels, of 12 novels. So, you know, read between the lines, you see a little of Don Gluten there.
Now, did you have experiences with the paranormal and the occult? Because you've dealt with that theme very often, including Dr. Spector. So is that something that's a passion of yours, or is it just a vehicle for writing good stories?
Well, for a while in the 60s, when I was a huge Dark Shadows fan, I did a lot of research into, like, authentic vampire legends and traditions and things like that, and through a smaller set of werewolves. But it was just, you know, a fascination with me. Like, I was fascinated by so many things, westerns, science fiction, superheroes, dinosaurs, you know, anything that was a little bit out of the ordinary, I was just interested in. I didn't believe in, I think for a while there, I was, because it was kind of trendy, you know, the 1960s, and we were trying things like automatic writing and ESP we were experimenting with, you know, but that kind of, you know, lasted maybe for a couple years, but I was never really heavily into any of that stuff. And now I just, you know, I just kind of ignore it, I guess.
My wife is a big Dark Shadows fan. And when I told her you were going to be on the show, one of the first things she remembered is she first learned of you when you were doing like occult type of things. So you did leave an impression on that field, even though you didn't like stay there long or do much with it publicly.
Well, I could tell you, you know, when this is kind of a long, well, I'll try to cut this short. I watched the early episodes of Dark Shadows, and, you know, that's when they were just, you know, the plots were all nothing supernatural. They were just blackmail and attempted murders and things like that, and I didn't like it. It replaced a rock and roll show that I did like called Where the Action Is. It was one of the Dick Clark shows. So I didn't watch it, but then the band, the Penny Arcade, had to go to Las Vegas because the two lead singers were doing the show there with Sheila McRae, and the other two, myself and the drummer, who were not in the show, were just stuck in the motel for about a week or so. And that's when I, to find things to do to pass the time, I turned on Dark Shadows, and it was when they first introduced Barnabas, but they didn't say yet that he was a vampire. So I was picking up on all the clues that nobody else was. And in the room, I think that guy's a vampire. No, there wouldn't be a vampire on television. Anyway, it turned out he was. I was right. And then when we went back to California, we would rehearse over in Mike Nesmith's house in a rehearsal room they had. On the other side of the house was he had a bar that had drinks and potato chips and other snacks, you know. It also had a little television set, a portable black and white TV set. And Dark Shadows came on at 4 o'clock, and I was already addicted to it, but we rehearsed all day, and we rehearsed 6 days a week, so we rehearsed during the time Dark Shadows was on. So I would look at my watch when it came 4 o'clock, and I would say something like, hey, you guys hungry? Can I get you a Slim Jim or, you know, something like that? I'll make some sandwiches and something to drink. And they would say, sure, that sounds great. So we would stop rehearsing. I'd run across the house, and he had a big house, to the bar, and I'd turn on the TV and watch maybe 5 or 6 minutes of the show to get a gist of what's going on. Then I would take the food back to the rehearsal room and say, oh, I forgot to bring the drinks. And then I would run back there and watch another 5 minutes. And if I was at somebody's house visiting, if we weren't rehearsing and I was visiting a friend or something, I would say, do you mind if, you know, 4 o'clock came up, can we just take a break for a half hour? And that's how I saw my first episodes. Of course, in later years with reruns and DVDs and VHS tapes and all that, I got to see the whole series a couple times. And but, yeah, I was a big, big Dark Shadows fan. I went to the Dark Shadows conventions and met the actors. And I actually got a Christmas card one year from Jonathan Frid, who played Barnabas.
Wow.
And then once I had lunch with Jonathan Flynn and David Selby. And then about, separate years ago, I was in Chicago at O'Hare Airport. And I got on the plane, and as I'm walking towards my economy, the El Cheapo section of the plane, and I'm walking through first class, I saw David Selby sitting there. And I stopped, and I said, I don't know if you remember me, but we had lunch together some years ago. And he said, let's talk afterwards. So while we were both getting our baggage at the baggage claim, we had another nice conversation. He was a wonderful man. He was very much like a classic Southern gentleman, you know, very personable. And he really was a nice guy. He still is.
My wife used to do the convention. She was one of the Collinsport players that used to put on those skits at the conventions.
Oh, really?
Yeah. She was.
Is she on any of those recordings? Is she on any of those CDs that were coming out for a while where they would get the old actors back and continue the storylines?
I don't know. I know I've seen some recordings of her doing her skits. When with the other people, they did like little comedy skits that were related to the shows. But I don't know if she was on any DVDs or CDs or anything. She was in the encyclopedia, the Dark Shadows Encyclopedia. Her picture was there with the Collinsport players.
I may have seen her because I saw some of those. I know one I saw, it was the first one that Nancy Barrett came to. And that was here in L.A., and I saw that, and it was very good. And last year, I don't know if they ran it or not, but last year, the actors from the show did their version of A Christmas Carol.
Oh, wow.
It was all by the camera because the pandemic was still going on. Oh, by the way, I don't know if I told you or if you know, but in my movie Tales of Frankenstein, one of my stars was Jerry Lacy, who played Reverend Trapp and other characters. And what a, you know, you can imagine what we talked to during the lunch break. We talked about Dark Shadows. And I told him the story of, you know, me and the band running to the television across Mike Nesmer's house. And he really laughed at that. But he's a great guy, good actor, really a good actor. And he came to the rap party and the cast and crew's world premiere we had, and I'd like to work with him more. I mean, he was really good.
You're very great at taking these actors and putting them into your projects, and that's a great thing you're doing, and I need to thank you for doing that, because these are fan favorite people, and they kind of go into obscurity, and you've made sure to keep them active and in the public eye, so that is great.
Yeah. In Tales of Frankenstein, I had three well-known actors from our fantasy days. One was Anne Robinson, who was in War of the Worlds, and many other things. And then also Beverly Washburn, who most people remember from Star Trek, but I remember her from Superman and the Mole Man. She's a little girl in there, maybe 10 years old or something. And these are people, you know, no airs of superiority, no prima donnas, nothing like that. They were just down to earth. In fact, when I was making those amateur movies, in one of them I got Glenn Strange to play the Frankenstein monster. In another one, it was a Superman film, and I got Roy Barkroth and Kenny Duncan to play Crooks. Now, you probably are not familiar with those names, but if you saw any, like, Roy Rogers movies or any B-Westerns or any of the Old Republic serials, you would see them all the time. They were ubiquitous in those. And they were just, again, just really, really, really nice guys. Another person we had in the Frankenstein movie was John Blythe Barrymore, who was, well, the grandson of John Barrymore, the grandnephew of Ethel and Lionel Barrymore, the half-brother of Drew Barrymore, and the son of John Drew Barrymore. So there was a lot of – I didn't have to rehearse him at all. I mean, he just inherited the acting gene from that was passed down. So there was a delightful experience working on that film.
Now, if you made so many films, how many films were you putting out in a year? Because that's an extraordinary number of films.
The amateur films were, you know, I mean, I made some of those when I was 9 years old. I mean, you can't really count those, but I made 41 of those. And then I made professional movies, 8, I think it was. Yeah, it's up to 8 now. If I could get some more money together, I'd be up to 9 or 10. But I have 2 scripts just ready to go. I just don't have the money to do it. And it's hard making your money back these days because the whole industry has changed so much.
Yeah.
You know, 20 years ago, you make a low-budget movie and, wow, you make your huge profits right away because everyone was hungry for product. But nowadays, you know, Amazon and Sci-Fi Channel, well, they're all making their own movies, so they're not buying movies. And people are, you know, at home making movies on their phone. You know, when I made movies, I had crews, you know. I had, you know, cameramen and first ADs and, you know, craft service people and makeup people and, you know, special effects people. It's just like music industry. When I was in the Penny Arcade, we would go into a studio, the whole band, and we set up our instruments in front of a microphone, and we played together. And that's the way that we recorded. And if you made a mistake, well, either you recorded the whole song again or you let the mistake in. And, you know, before that, and we did the vocal tracks separately, but, you know, before that, like in the days of Bing Crosby, he would sing, I think even Elvis, he would sing while the band was playing. And nowadays, you know, the bass guitar player could, you know, records his track on a computer at home and he just mails it in and they put it all together. And if one of the instruments is out of tune, they can correct it on the, or going a little bit too slow, they can correct it on the computer. So
yeah,
the whole experience about playing together, you know, which was a great joy, and a lot of creativity came out of that because people played off each other. If one guy was getting into kind of a riff or, you know, something, the other one could kind of, you know, complement that. But you can't do that anymore because everybody does everything, their own part separately, and they send it in. So publishing, music, people are making movies on their phones now. You know, they go in the backyard and they shoot a movie. And I can't work that way. I need a crew and I need a fairly decent budget and actors that are, you know, I like to use some prominent real actors. I don't use a lot of people that are stereotyped for doing B movies or, you know, I try to stay away from that if I can. So it's more difficult for me to get a movie off the ground than somebody else who just goes in the backyard and gets some has-been actor or, you know, screen queen or something from 40 years ago. And makes her a movie. I can't work that way.
Now, you're well known enough that maybe a GoFundMe, people would be definitely curious as to what you're up to, and maybe that's a route to go. Have you ever tried those online funding sources?
Oh, I've tried it, and disastrous for me anyway. You know, I've got 5,000 Facebook friends, and I've launched about 4 or 5 different Indiegogo campaigns and one, I think, Kickstarter. And I figured if every one of them just sent me a dollar, I'd have at least $5,000 to get going. And all I would get would be likes and happy faces and people saying, oh, good luck, that sounds like a great idea. But almost nobody sent me any money. So they didn't work for me. For other people, they've been great. I don't know how they do it. But I had, you know, I had trailers on there. I shot videos with the actors asking for money, and it just never seemed to really work. And then if you are successful, then you're straddled with all kinds of people you have to keep track of and send them things and make sure you don't forget someone. And if you make too many promises, that could be
right,
a real annoyance for the rest of your life, you know.
Wow. That I did not know that.
Yeah, you know, everybody wants to be a well-wisher, but contributing even a dollar or something is like pulling teeth. It really is. I never knew it would be so difficult, because I would get, you know, all these responses like, oh, you were such an inspiration to me. You got me off drugs and all then, you know, I was ready to pull the trigger, and then I saw one of your movies, you know, which is a huge responsibility. But they're great with the compliments, but not with helping out financially. So, and I don't want to go with the Patreon thing. I just, that to me is just like begging on the street corner or something. I got my pride, you know.
Okay. Yeah, we're starting to look into some of those to further some of the things that we're doing. I remember I had a fringe TV show in Manhattan it was called Floor of the Barbarian. And I used to wander around New York with a sword on my back and had adventures, and people were recording it with mini DV cams. And I remember back then I had cameramen, I had editors, I had musicians, I had all sorts of people involved. And now I see people making things, I'm making things on YouTube with a $20 camera and a USB port. So, it is a different world. And
you know, the last two movies I financed myself. And everybody said, don't do that, you're crazy. Well, for me, you know, even though I won't tell you how much they cost, it was quite a bit, but the alternative was sitting around doing nothing, you know, just sitting around writing or doing one of the greatest joys of my life is going through the whole experience of making a movie, step by step by step, you know, writing the script, doing the casting, doing the actual shooting, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But for the other six movies, I sought out investors. And that's nightmarish, doing that, because nobody wants to give you money. But everybody wants to be part of the Hollywood scene, you know. They want to go to the parties and meet the pretty actresses and all that sort of thing. But when it gets down to that moment of truth, where they got to take a pen in their hand and write you a check, somebody, their CPA, their financial advisor, their spouse, will say, you don't want to take a risk. Movies are the riskiest thing in the world. If you're going to invest in anything, invest in something like property or the stock market, where you got a better chance of getting your money back. And then suddenly you're left out there. I mean, I threw parties for people who were like these Middle Eastern oil sheiks and things. They would come over. I would have food and drinks and pretty hostesses dressed up like cave girls, you know, when I made my Dinosaur Relatives movie. And they would, you know, and then one guy came, we did that, and he was all set to write us a check. And then he, at the last minute, he bought property in Malibu, which in a month later went down the hill in a flood. Another person who I met in Chicago was all gung-ho, and he was a multimillionaire. And he said, okay, I'm going to be in California in 2 months, and I'm going to come out there, and I'm going to I will invest, I don't know, it was $30,000 or something we're talking about. And we had an office, and we had a studio at the time, and we did our dog and pony show. We had on the wall photos of the actors we wanted to use, headshots. We had storyboard art that Frank Runner, a great comic book artist, had done. And we were all set to go. And the night before the meeting, he called me, I'm in California. Okay, tomorrow I'll see you at the office, and I will write you the check. Next morning, the meeting was scheduled for 10 o'clock. At 9 o'clock in the morning, I get a phone call, and it's him. And he said, I got bad news for you. My wife won't let me do it. And you gotta understand that if anybody's gonna write you a check, even if it's only for $1,000 or something, if they're serious about investing in something, they're not. The first rule in investing is don't take a risk. And the risk for a movie is the highest risk you can take. So you're not going to get a professional investor necessarily to invest in your movie. I found out that the people that were investing in my movies were people that had some kind of a connection, want to be a connection with the entertainment business. People that had film collections in their basement or once played in a rock band, a garage band, and they missed a performance, you know, that sort of thing. Those are the ones where the money didn't seem to matter that much. What mattered was they were part of the entertainment business again. And finding those people would take me years. It would take me 2-3 years to finance one little, you know, $100,000 movie or $70,000 movie. And it just got to be too much of an aggravation. And a lot of the people didn't understand that movies were limited partnerships and you were not guaranteeing that they were even getting one penny back. And it was said that in the agreement that they signed. But they didn't read the agreement, apparently, or understand it and or question it. And then I would get these phone calls at, you know, midnight, 2 o'clock in the morning. When are we going to see some money? And you try to explain to them, well, we're going to the film market with it. You know, but all these things take time. And even if you go to the American film market, you would get a buyer who was interested in your movie, but it might take another year for the deal to close. And they just didn't understand that, you know. So I decided I had a huge comic book collection. And I said, I would rather make movies than have this comic book collection that I never look at anymore. So I put it up for auction. I sold it. I got hit big time by Uncle Sam for taxes. Nevertheless, I had a whole lot of credit cards to pay the balance off, and we made that first movie, Dances with Werewolves, and then I decided to make another one, which was Tales of Frankenstein, which I financed myself. But now I have nobody to answer to. I have no partners. I have nobody to call me up in the middle of the night saying, where's my money? It's all the success or the failure will be on my shoulders, and that's a great feeling.
That is a great feeling, and that is a wise move that you made, and I'm going to contemplate it and learn from it, because several things I was contemplating on doing now don't seem as good ideas as they did before I spoke with you, so thank you.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, I'm a creative person. I'm not a businessman. I'm not a techno guy, but a friend of mine who is a very successful businessman gave me, actually two friends gave me very good bits of advice that I really stick to now. One is never get into a partnership with anybody if you can do the job yourself. And if you do get into a partnership with somebody, make sure the partner has more to lose than you do. You know, and I go by that, and it's working out for me.
Very, very good. That is awesome. So moving away from movies and into the comic books, what type of comic books are you doing these days?
Well, they're all horror comics. And, you know, I love the old classic horror movies. So a lot of them have vampires and werewolves and mummies and things like that. And they all kind of have a surprise EC-like ending. And most of them start off with a title. I get an idea for a title. And then I try to figure out some kind of a surprise ending that goes with the title. I still don't know what the story is going to be about. And then I sit down at my computer and I start typing. And within about 4 hours, the story is done. It comes out to 6 pages, almost every time 6 pages, which is a real convenient page length for me. But I'll get an idea for a title. I'll be watching television, and somebody will say something. And I'll say, boy, you just changed one word. Like somebody mentioned, we're talking about the Alamo. And they say, remember the Alamo. And I said, well, we just changed one letter. We got this member of the Alamo. What could that be? And I said, what if the last night before the big battle where Santa Ana wiped everybody out, what if the last night Colonel Travis is finding out that his forces are being depleted, which he can't afford because he needs the money in there. And they discover that every one of the guys, his men that have died, have been drained of blood, and there's these two marks on their neck. But nobody's ever heard of what a vampire is. And they got a, luckily there's this Spanish guy there who remembered a story that he heard in Spain and all this. And they literally, the last night before the big battle, the next morning, there's a hunt for where the vampire is. And they have to destroy the vampire before they can fight Santa Ana. And, in these kinds of stories with historical bases, I do a lot of research. And mm-hmm. I found out, like, what was the bugle charge and all this sort of thing. And I got to use Davy Crockett and Jim Bowie, and it was great. I had Davy Crockett borrowing Jim Bowie's Bowie knife to fight the vampire, to cut his head off. And I did stories now with Frank Nitti and Jesse James, and I don't know if the readers even know who these characters are, but I do a lot of research. Elliot Ness, and I've got one with the Wild Bill Hickok coming out. And I just love doing those kind of historically based stories with real characters, and because I like doing the research. I like, searching the internet and finding out. Yeah, I had one where the one with Frank Nitti, I had Elliot Ness in there. But it's when the Untouchables have broken up and Ness is going to, Ohio or Pennsylvania or someplace for his next job. And he's going to help Frank Nitti out, who's his mortal enemy, to fight this vampire, that Nitti's responsible. And I call the story not the Untouchables, but the Undeadables. And that was one of those things that came out with a title. I was thinking about the Untouchables television show, and suddenly, just changed a couple letters. You got the Undeadables. And that's how it came to be. But I love doing the research and putting in the actual facts of things that nobody's probably going to ever notice in the story. And that's an actual fact. They'll think, but that's okay. I enjoy doing it. And I guess that's an important thing. I'm the associate editor on those magazines now too. So, which means I get to proofread them.
That is fantastic. And, you, and it sounds like you're on creatively all the time because you allow the world to inspire you and spark off your creativity.
Yeah, well, all my life, I think I may have said this to you on one of the previous broadcasts, but the alternative is getting a job, which is horrendous for me. I mean, I have almost very few real jobs in my life. And none of them lasted more than about a month and a half. And some of them were for monetary reasons or to impress a girlfriend's mother who didn't think writing was a job, that kind of stuff. So I'm always looking for something to do. I'm also, in case you don't know it, the West Coast representative of Las Vegas Talent Agency, which is a big agency in Las Vegas.
You told me about that.
Yeah, actors and musicians and ventriloquists and models and everything. And, they mostly get work in Las Vegas, but they just think they have gigs sometimes in Los Angeles and other cities. So I'm always looking for talent and people I can recommend. And I'm working just kind of on a commission basis, but I have business cards and everything. And so that's another thing that keeps me busy.
That must be very satisfying too, to be continually aware of like new talent, sometimes talent that's a little bit off the beaten path, not standard, and to be able to provide them with opportunities. That sounds awesome.
Oh yeah, and I like helping people. I really like helping people out. If I have a friend who, is embarking on some kind of a career, I try, setting them up with the right people and giving them the phone numbers a call and that sort of thing, introducing the people, getting them out there, networking. Networking is so important. Many of my jobs where I just happen to be out at the right time in the right place, But a lot of people don't go to the right place or the right time because they stay home and wait for the phone to ring. And, you know, I'm always out there hustling. That was another bit of advice that Ron Haydock, who was kind of a rockabilly musician friend of mine who also was in the horror films and did a monster magazine, told me. He said, Don, you got to hustle. And I never forgot that. And I'm hustling all the time.
And opportunities come your way, so it works.
I'll give an example of that. The way the whole Penny Arcade music thing, I mean, I played in a lot of rock bands, you know, garage bands, as they're called, I guess, in Chicago when I was a teenager and a couple out here. But a friend of mine happened to be at the Musicians Union, and he saw a little note on the bulletin board saying, new band looking for a bass player. And he was a bass player too. And he said, he told me, hey, I saw this note. I didn't want to bother. It's just another one of those things. You want to try it? Go ahead. And I did, and I got it. And that's the one Mike Nesmith produced. And he resented me the rest of his life that I had somehow stolen it from him, you know. Another time I was, Jim Harmon used to call it my Don Glut's infernal luck. I went down to check my mail in the apartment building I was in. And as I was opening the mailbox and taking the mail out, a woman happened to walk by on the sidewalk outside the building, and she stopped and did a double take. And I had pretty long hair then, and said, Are you 17 years old? I said, no, I'm 21 or 22. Okay, well, tell them you're 19. Okay, we're shooting. They're having auditions for a TV commercial right now, and you look like you would be perfect for the commercial. Be there in like 45 minutes or something. So I went down there, and there's all these young guys sitting out there reading scripts with their stage mothers next to them, you know. And they called me in, they gave me the script, and it was a Breck hairspray commercial with Dick Clark. And,
oh, wow.
And so I sat there, I just read the lines, you know, best I could. I had no real professional acting training, and they liked it, like my person. And they said, can you do it, you know, put a little bit of force. I said, how about if I do it like John Wayne? They said, what? Okay, sure. So I did it like John Wayne. You know, and I got it. And all these other people who were like professionals who were studying the lines and everything, they didn't get the job. And I did the job with Dick Clark, and I finally got it on my website. I'm not a techno guy, but I had a 16 millimeter kinescope of it since we did the show. And but I didn't know how to get on my website, but I finally figured out going through a private YouTube channel and all this, you know. And so it's on there. If anybody wants to see it, they can go to DonLeftGlut.com, and where it says About Don, somewhere in there is there. You can click on the commercial and see it and hear it.
You still there?
I lived off that commercial. For about 2 years because of the residuals. Dick Clark would run that commercial on American Bandstand almost every week for 2 years.
Oh, wow. That is awesome. And I know the greater things await you ahead. Can you give us any hints as to anything that we could see popping up in the near future?
Well, there's somebody, and I don't know if it's fizzled out. I haven't heard from them in a while. Somebody got in touch with me about a year ago. They wanted to do an animated TV cartoon show based on my New Adventures of Frankenstein novel series.
Oh, awesome.
And that, who knows, that may be coming up. Marvel keeps reprinting a lot of my old stuff in
great.
These omnibus volumes and beautiful editions. I mean, they're really expensive, but they look really good. The Dinosaur Valley Girls reissue is coming out, the Blu-ray, kind of restored. And these old books of mine are coming out. I've got one new book in that series, which is a, remember Monsters to Laugh With? Stan Lee's, not Monsters to Laugh, was that the name of it? It was a bunch of photographs from old movies that had funny captions.
Yes.
Old
yes,
horror
yes.
film. Well, this would be a book based on my movie Tales of Frankenstein. I took, I forgot how many, a couple hundred photos from it, and I wrote funny captions. That was a fun project to do, but I don't know when that's going to be out. That's already, you know, the publisher has it, and that'll be coming out by, this is from the same publisher that's doing, you know, all these reissues of classic movie monsters and the Dracula book and the serials book and the old TV show book and all those. There's a lot of stuff. So there's a lot of stuff coming out that I didn't put a lot of work into. The Frankenstein Dracula and classic movie monsters book, you know, are really out of date. And there's a lot of misinformation in some of them because those are written at a time before we had the internet or home video. I mean, a lot of it was through memory and reading other sources and educated guessing and that sort of thing. So I said, okay, I'll let you reprint those books on a couple of conditions. One is that you let me upgrade all the photos. Second is that I don't have to update the book. I don't want to be writing about, you know, young Frankenstein and all these things that happened since the book came out. But I want to have an afterword, a detailed, long afterword, where I do two things. I correct any mistakes that are in the actual main text of the book, and any things I missed or didn't know about up until the point of publication of those books. So in my, I think Frankenstein Legend came out in 73 or so, nothing beyond 1973, but there was a lot of stuff I didn't know about up until 1973. Let me write about all that sort of thing. And I also didn't want to change the original text. For one reason, it would be an awful lot of work, which I didn't have time to do or interest in doing. But a lot of people grew up on those books. They took them out of the library and all this, you know, and they had a certain nostalgic interest in those books. So I wanted to preserve that nostalgia for them while correcting the mistakes and updating up until that point, the text with the afterword. And now, as I said, two of those books have already come out. They're available on Amazon, and Classic Movie Monsters should be out this spring. And Classic Movie Monsters has all the other, you know, characters, Wolf, Werewolf, Wolfman, Mummy, Invisible Man, Jekyll and Hyde, King Kong, Godzilla, et cetera, et cetera.
As a way of saying thank you for inspiring me and keeping me entertained, and I'm in my 60s now, so your art has been there throughout much of my life, I'd like to help promote anything new that's coming out. I have around 5,000 Facebook friends, too. In one of my accounts, I have a second account with like 800 or so, and then things I do like Sword and Sandal Cinema, there's around 30,000 people in the various groups there. So if you can help spread the word in any way, all you need to do is send me a link in a personal message or an email, and I'll be glad to share it.
Okay. By the way, I knew two more of those sword and sandal guys. Peter Lupus, for a while, was trying to get financing for a mummy movie we were making, but he never came through with it. But his son, I think it was named Peter Lupus Jr., did some of the post-production work on Dinosaur Valley Girls. And also when I used to go to parties and things with Ed Fury, one of his friends I got to know, who deceased now, I'm trying to think, Reg Parks, who was the other one? He did a Machiste film with dinosaurs. Reg Lewis.
Reg Lewis,
yeah. I knew that, Reg Lewis. And, you know, not very tall guy, but These are fun guys. They had a good sense of humor and everything. You know, it's I'm glad I got to know those three. I think those are the only three that I actually knew on a friendship basis.
If you'd like to talk about your relationship with them and your memories of them, I have a Sword and Sandal show every week, We have people, like, for instance, I've had the folks from the Steve Reeves estate. Steve Reeves International come on numerous times. I have somebody who was friends with Reg Park that I'm trying to schedule now. And if you'd like to talk about your memories of Peter Lupus, Ed Fury, and Reg Lewis, I would definitely be interested in hearing those stories.
Okay, I don't know how much I would have to tell you. And most of my stories would come from Ed Fury, because we actually, you know, would hang out to go to parties and things, he and his wife and I, in restaurants and things like that. He was fun to work with on the movie set. I mean, sang and you know, Karen Black was on that movie too, and they were the, you know, they were like comedy partners behind the scenes. And he lost a lot of weight by then. He became a vegetarian, so he didn't have the physique he once had. But I think Ed, I haven't talked to him in about 20 years, but I hear he's still alive and must be up there pretty in years. I don't know how old he is, but yeah, sure. I don't know how long we talked, but I could tell you everything I remember. That would be good.
Okay, we only have a couple of minutes today, and I'd like to close with your letting people know what the best way to find you. You're on Facebook, and you have a wonderful website. You said you have five websites.
Yeah, and if they go to I got about five websites. The main one, the core one, I guess you might call it, is just my name, www.donaldfglute.com. No periods in the middle or hyphens or anything like that. And there are links to all the other websites there. And there's also an email link, a contact link. So I'm really pretty easy to find. I mean, you found me, so, you know, it wasn't too difficult, was it? Everybody else, if they go to that website, they can find out more than they'll ever want to know, and probably more than they ever will know about me, and how to reach me and all that sort of thing. The Facebook is good, too. I have two Facebook pages, my regular one, and then the fan one, or the professional one, whatever you want to call it.
Well, thank you so very much for the interview and also for being you. And as I've said, you've played a significant role in my creative life, and I thank you for that. And I'm looking forward to our next conversation already. An hour was way too short.
Thank you for putting me on again. I always enjoy doing your show, and it's been a while since we talked, and I'm glad to be back.
And thanks again. Thanks to everybody tuned in, whether you called in and you're patiently waiting in our queue, whether you clicked on a link and found yourself here, or whether you'll be checking us out later on demand. Until next time, this is us wishing you joyous journeys and amazing adventures. And thank you very much again, Donald F. Glute.
Thank you.